Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. We talk about the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I am your host, Eric Maxterino. Very sadly, Juliet Liu cannot join us today, but she'll be back in the next episode. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone that if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world, like the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. I think it's fair to say that there's a common perspective, or at least in America and with the people I speak with that aren't global China researchers specific, that Chinese firms, or especially state-owned Chinese firms, have unlimited or very deep pockets when it comes to overseas investments, or at least a higher appetite of investment risk than their American or European or Japanese or Korean multinational counterparts. But is this the case? You know, also, if you follow Belt and Road Belt and Road news or Belt and Road type infrastructure projects closely, or really dove into many of the great global China investment data sets, as I suppose many of our listeners have, you'll probably notice that there are many projects that once were MOUs or media rumors that never materialized. Sure, there are some, many times that's on the host country end where host country cancels it, but other times and many times Chinese firms just don't go forward with the project. So that means there is some form of calculated investment risk that Chinese state-owned firms have, even in strategic sectors. But how? How do Chinese firms approach investment risk? Is it any different than traditional multinationals? And if the calculations are different, how are they different? These are questions I often ask myself, and so I was so pleased to run into the latest edition of the Review of International Political Economy. In it was a brilliant new article from a former guest of the show, Dr. Alvin Kamba, entitled How Chinese Firms Approach Investment Risk, Strong Leaders, Cancellation, and Pushback. I found the research to be quite groundbreaking, and I knew I had to have him back on the show. Alvin is an assistant professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and also a non-resident fellow at the Climate Policy Lab at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Alvin, welcome back to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Oh, hey, Eric, how are you? Thank you for having me back.
Yes. So your paper deals with Chinese firm approach to investment risk. Can you give a brief overview of the academic debate on Chinese FDI investment risk assessments? What are the basic schools of thoughts and the similarities or difference between how Chinese firms assess risk and other type and firms from other countries?
Okay, sure. So I started this paper by looking at the literature on Chinese foreign direct investments. Of course, when we think about Chinese firms approaching risk, it's not just about foreign direct investments. We are talking about construction contracts or sort of any other sort of participation of Chinese firms in the host country. There's a major literature that it's been called Chinese exceptionalism. This literature emerged, I think, somewhere in the United Kingdom in the late, I think around 2008, 2009. When a couple of like quantitative researchers, particularly working in business schools, started to gather data sets on like Chinese firms and to sort of correlate them with particular variables that we know often used in foreign direct investment studies. So natural endowments, quality of institutions, governance, resource initiatives, a lot of this. So what these people basically did is they took the tools that people use in the FDI determinants literature, and instead of like looking at, let's say, Western multinational firms, they look at Chinese firms. And what they found is that Chinese firms, and there are different variations around it, what they found is that Chinese firms do not follow the same patterns as Western / Japanese or Korean multinationals. What these people found is that Chinese firms do not care about the quality of institutions in the host country. They do not care about corruption. What they care about would be natural resources, or they care about the relationship with the host country. So what they basically argue is that, so this is a big contrast with the literature on, let's say, Western MNCs, where Western MNCs care about governance, they care about limiting corruption, they care about political risks. In many ways, the Chinese firms do not care about those things. This is what the literature argues. And the mechanism that they often talk about, and there are many different mechanisms, but the main mechanism that this literature uses is the idea that you have policy bank and government financing for Chinese firms. So because you have this financing, you have this major state-led financing, it absolves Chinese firms from dealing with risks that Western multinationals often deal with, and therefore they approach risk differently. Now, while this is a big literature and you find this in a lot of business studies journals, there is an emerging group of works, particularly coming from the United States, people who come from, let's say, political science and people who come from economics. And what they found is that Chinese firms don't really act so differently from Western multinationals. More often than not, these people use more sophisticated data sets and more sophisticated techniques to sort of tease out how Chinese firms act. And in many ways, they use the more recent advances in the FDI determinants literature. And what these people found is that, oh, actually, the smart Chinese firms in many ways act like Western firms. So these are the two major debates in the literature on how Chinese firms approach risk.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Your article looks to fill in what you saw as a gap in the literature on Chinese FDI studies by including the social embeddedness of firms and also other qualitative factors to put those into account when assessing Chinese firm risk calculations. What do you mean by social embeddedness, and why do you find it important to consider it when trying to understand how Chinese firms gauge investment risk?
Sure. Thank you for that question. So I'm a sociologist. In sociology, a major concept we have is this idea of embeddedness. The main premise behind embeddedness is that when we think about firms or entities or people, individuals, apart from this more theoretical idea behind social relations, the main concept behind it is that every individual or every firm or every entity, we attribute a particular meanings to specific things. And these meanings, in many ways, emerge from our upbringing, our socialization, and the people around us. Now, given that premise, I argue that the Chinese society, and say the Chinese state, the People's Republic of China specifically, it has its own set of social relations that grew out of, say, the rise of communism during the Mao era, the rise of China in the 1980s, and sort of the going out policy, the going out in the world. All of these things are complicated, and they have their own specific meanings that in many ways would differ from, let's say, the American experience of, let's say, we can never disconnect ourselves from, let's say, the society around us, from social relations. We're always tied to social relations. So going back to, for instance, Karl Polanyi, who talks about the idea of the rise of capitalism, the rise of marketization in the 19th century, Polanyi was talking about how, you know, in as much as like marketization leads to disembedding markets from society, society always attempts to re-embed it back. Now, apart from this more Keynesian Fordist economy in the 1930s, then you have like the war-led economy by the 40s, then you have the Keynesian economy from 60s to 80s, then you have the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s. So every society would have their own like social experience grounded in some sort of political, economic, and social formation, and that would affect how individuals, entities, and firms approach risk. So that's the idea behind embeddedness. And it's important to consider it because in as much as we can agree that, okay, firms are after profit, the definition of what is profit and how much of profit is enough profit would differ from society to society. The definition of what is a dangerous city would differ from place to place. In the same ways, firms would, of course, vary as well in how they understand risk. That would differ from place to place as well, the experience of the firms to their own sort of understanding behind it and to their own understanding of the people in the firms themselves of what is risky.
One portion of social embeddedness that you bring up in terms of Chinese firms, and then, of course, how Chinese firms assess risk down the road, is you discuss the importance of party school education in influencing investment risk decision. What is taught at these party schools in relation to foreign investment, and how do they influence Chinese firm investment decisions?
So this is something I discuss much further in my dissertation. So in the article that I publish in Ripe, it's more of an offshoot version of my dissertation when I sort of look at Chinese firms. But my dissertation looks at the Chinese state per se. And of course, firms come sort of alongside it, but I focus on the state in my dissertation. But going to your question, this was something that emerged from interviews that I've had with members with the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs or members of, let's say, MOFCOM or individuals who represent or who work for Chinese firms at different levels. They specifically talk about how the Chinese party schools, a lot of the more dogmatic sort of communist-like ideas, you know, emerged in the 50s to the 80s. That started to change by, let's say, late 80s, early 90s, and 2000s, when the way that the different things they taught in the school, in many ways, it doesn't reflect orthodox communism anymore. Party school education reflects globalization, modernization, China's role in the world. What does it mean for development to happen? So a lot of these things are taught in the party school. More interesting that I found is something that came out from the interviews. It was the understanding of Chinese firms of other countries and how other countries develop. So one particular common thing that came out from interviewing officials was the idea that East Asian states develop because they had strong states. And you could not find it in, say, Southeast Asian countries, where you often have one leader replacing another. And state institutions are often vulnerable to the whims of the individuals. Whereas in the East Asian countries, and more often than not, the Chinese firms and China imagine themselves as part of this, you have strong states, strong individuals that limit elite competition. So that is something that I found in the party school education. And when they approach, let's say, Southeast Asian countries, or when they approach investing in this in the states that I've looked at, a lot of this factors sort of come in sort of assessing investment risk.
So social embeddedness and these other qualitative factors for understanding Chinese investment risk, I mean, a lot of it seems very intuitive, at least to me, in comparison to lots of the quantitative studies that have happened before. But I imagine one reason as to why many studies thus far had been these quantitative studies, because it's incredibly difficult to assess such a question, a research question, in a systemic manner. And to attack this Herculean task, you interviewed over 120 elites over the span of 3 years, or 4 years, that include Chinese firm reps, presidential advisors, senators, parliamentarians, party members, oligarchs, Chinese ministry officials, and embassy representatives, and think tanks within throughout various countries in Southeast Asia and in mainland China. First, how did you do this? That's a really incredible task to do. And two, how did you structure the research and this interview process? Did you go into this whole interview with these specific questions in mind, or did it change throughout after you got some answers? Tell me about how you structured the research.
Okay, so this was my dissertation idea very early on, I think around 2017. I had this idea first that there's a tendency for them to invest in particular countries that limits elite competition. So before, I wasn't looking at the leader per se. I was sort of looking at how countries that limit elite competition, you have elite consolidation. And in countries where you do have massive amounts of elite competition, it does lead to problems for Chinese firms. And this is a common observation. You find this in many different like case studies for people who work on China in the global south. Now, this idea of analyzing, like, for instance, how do particular let's say Chinese actors and host state actors understand each other. How do Chinese actors understand strength? This came about, I think, 2018. In many ways, I was trying to sort of keep this idea under wraps. When people ask me about my dissertation, I sort of give them some sort of vague idea or a totally different idea that sort of like came out 5 seconds before I talked to them. Mainly because I did not want them to, I did not want to get scooped, which is very common, unfortunately, in my line of work, in our line of work. Oh, shoot. It's horrible, really. People like stealing your ideas. But moving on from that, the number of interviews, honestly, is 250, 254. That's since 2016. Of course, for the article version, I push it down because I really did not use a lot. And I did not really explain the other cases here, like Indonesia and Malaysia. So how did I start? How did I do this? The Philippine case was really easy for me to do. I'm not sure if I told you, but my mom had a cabinet level position back in the Philippines, back in the mid-2000s. That cabinet level position, it gave me access to a lot of Philippine elites, from senators to oligarchs to party members. And their connections actually helped me reach out to Chinese firm officials and Chinese embassy officials who worked during the Arroyo administration and the Aquino administration and the Duterte administration. I remember when I was a kid, my mom had a cabinet level position. She was also the head of the Office of the Development Aid Agency that was in charge of negotiating with the Chinese firms. And I remember I was living in Thailand at that time when I was finishing my schooling. But at the same time, I remember going back to the Philippines. And then like my mom had meetings with the Exim Bank officials who wanted to, like, what they call this, give money to the North Rail project that was canceled in 2012. And I did not understand the meeting. I just remember like being in a hotel and my mom tells me to sit on the other side. And then I remember mom seeing this like Chinese individuals in suits. And of course they pay for everything. And I remember like ordering whatever I wanted. So a lot of these things, when I went back to do my research, they remember my mom, they remember like the connections. And in many ways, this is how I started it. Sort of it snowballed into like, talking to many different people and different things. Now, Indonesia and Malaysia are much more complicated. It was a lot harder for me to sort of get into the networks, but I was able to eventually, thanks to many individuals, friends and family, and people I know back in school. who really helped me sort of tap into the political elite leadership. Now, that's how I accessed the individuals per se. The question is, what was the process behind it, right? What was the interview process? So it's a bit semi-structured and structured. It's semi-structured in a way that I did not know who I was going to interview. I did not know who I was going to meet. It was more like I was trying to get as many people as possible. At the same time, there was also some structure to it based on, I was trying to see what do Chinese actors think of the host country leader or leaders at that time. So people I interviewed, for instance, during the Duterte administration, you know, I was asking them what, if they were during the Arroyo time, I was asking them, oh, okay, what did you think about Arroyo? What happened during her time? How come there was a lot of money invested in Arroyo, even though there was a lot of elite competition? So I was trying to triangulate, like I was trying to see what Chinese actors, state officials alike, thought of the particular host country leader. At the same time, I was triangulating that with what the host country elites thought of what the Chinese actors were thinking at that time. So a lot of the host country officials I talked to, they were working with the Chinese officials, and in many ways, they knew them personally. So talking to the host country officials allowed me to sort of triangulate what the Chinese officials were thinking and what they thought and what they think. So sort of triangulating all of this with, let's say, government, their actions through, let's say, government documents, firm level documents. And sort of from there, it's sort of coming up with some sort of idea of what were they really thinking of the leader at that time. Now, what's more important is that when I was talking to these individuals, particularly the Chinese actors, I wasn't just accepting what they were saying. In many ways, I was trying to interrogate their beliefs at that particular time. So for instance, when talking about Arroyo, I was really asking them, why did they give money to Arroyo in 2007 for the ZTE project? And why did they give Arroyo money for the North Rail project in 2003, 2004, when she was already dealing with so much protest and so much elite conflict within the Philippines during that time? It did not make sense. Why did SGCC invest in 2009 when they had to deal with this, when they were dealing with these issues? And when did they realize that, oh, she's actually not a good investment? How did they realize it? When did they realize it? So a lot of this question, that structure is something I repeated, across from Arroyo, Duterte, Najib, and Jokowi, which are the main cases of my dissertation and my article. Well, my article, the latter two were shadow cases, but in my dissertation, I had one chapter each. So that was the idea behind it, triangulation, interrogation. At the same time, a crucial part of this is that in my dissertation, I also interviewed host country experts. So host country experts are academics in the particular Southeast Asian countries who actually, not just academics, journalists, sort of like we call them thought leaders in the Philippines. They're very familiar with what's happening with the political life in the country. So I was interviewing them and I was asking them what they thought of the leader's strength. So what I was doing then is that my interviews with host country leaders and Chinese officials, host country officials and Chinese officials, the interviews get a perceived strength of the leader. And interviewing the host country expert, I get at the actual strength of the leader. So it's basically a 2x2 where I sort of map out perceiving actual strength in my dissertation. And the article does it in some way. And from there, I sort of try to create a 2x2. And I call this in my dissertation, I call this the strong leader trap, where there's a misconception, there's a misalignment between perception and actuality. And in all the circumstances, it leads to suboptimal outcomes for the Chinese state and the Chinese firm.
Well, yeah, that's a really great interlude to the next question, and really incredible everything you did. We do recommendations at the end of the show. I'm already going to say the recommendation of having you on the show is to read the paper that was just released. So anyway, incredible work. But let's get to the case study. As you said, for this article, you really focused on the Philippines, and you looked at two leadership periods in the Philippines. And you split into two categories, as you just said, although you had it written as sometimes leaders that were perceived to be strong but were actually weak, and then also leaders that are perceived to be strong and actually strong. Yeah. In the Philippines, you compared the leadership periods of Arroyo and Duterte. What categories did you place these leaders in and why?
Sure. So starting with the process that I talked about a while ago, right? I had a systematic process to sort of place these leaders in particular categories. The process that interviewed Chinese host country officials for perceived strength and then actual strength, I used host country experts. Now, Arroyo was categorized as perceived to be strong, actually weak. And Duterte was categorized to be perceived to be strong and actually strong. Well, the systematic process for me, the suboptimal outcome that emerges from perceived to be strong but actually weak is it leads to cancellation. It leads to the cancellation of major Chinese projects or increasing the likelihood of cancellation. Now, if the leader is perceived to be strong and actually strong, it leads to pushback. So again, those are the categories and the outcomes that I associate with falling in these particular places.
And strong and weak is the ability for a central leader to control regional or non-central elites, correct? How do you define weak or strong? Yeah.
Yeah, right. You're talking about actual strength, right?
Yeah.
So actual strength. So I had three So in the article, you find it in the footnote of the article and in my dissertation. So I had three definitions. There's a real literature on strong men and big men in political science. But apart from that, there's a broader theoretical literature on Max Weber, Michael Mann, you know, patrimonialist and bureaucratic leadership. So for me, it sort of falls into that. But from reading all of these things, I came up with like three particular sort of like standards, which would be the capacity to bypass institutions when and if necessary, the capacity and willingness to use force against other elites and social movements. And finally, if you're popular yourself amongst elites and social movements, if you have your own faction, if you're actually widely popular. So those are my standards of like weak and strong. In many ways, it actually works because in interviewing host country experts, most of the interviews actually align with these three standards. And like, does Duterte fall in these three standards? For sure. Do the host country experts think Duterte is a strong leader? For sure as well.
Yeah. And so I think you mentioned this a little bit already, but so what risks did you find that Chinese firms take when they overestimate the strength of a leader? Like, what happened in the Philippines?
So the Arroyo administration, in many ways, she was perceived to be strong. In some ways, she was in the early 2000s. She was very popular. Arroyo was popular. She came into power in, I was 10 years old. I don't remember. So she came into power in the early 2000s, and she swore in front of hundreds of thousands of people that she was going to be the next Philippine president. She had the firm backing of the Philippine military and Philippine police and many of the Philippine elites. In the next couple of years, there was an erosion of her power. And eventually, despite that erosion, the Chinese firms kept on investing, whether it's construction contracts or foreign direct investments. And then eventually, despite these things happening, investments kept on happening. And then elite competition happened. You have elite mobilization, Supreme Court injunctions to Senate and congressional sort of overrides on Arroyo's executive actions. You have impeachment attempts against her multiple times. You have social movements, civil society members mobilizing for three straight months every day, approximately 45,000 to 100,000 people in the business center of the Philippines. So you have all of these actions against Arroyo demanding her resignation. And despite that happening, Chinese firms kept on investing. When Arroyo was finally, in some ways, some of the Chinese projects were linked to embezzlement and corruption scandals. So the elites and the civil society demanded that the Chinese projects get canceled. Eventually, Arroyo was unable to protect the Chinese projects and most of the Chinese projects in the Philippines got canceled. The other effect is that some Chinese projects were not even involved in corruption, but because they were perceived to be corrupt, because they were, well, a Chinese project, they also ended up getting canceled. So those were other problems.
This wasn't maybe specifically in the article, but potentially was in your dissertation. Has there been a change within the Chinese state within either at the party score or in terms of how they interact with non-central leaders or parties that are not in power? And so how has the Chinese state really worked with? Because even if you have a strong leader that actually is strong, I mean, how do you measure the durability of that strength over time?
Are you asking like if the Chinese actors interact with other elites and try to build relationships with other like
members? Yeah, has that been the response in the Philippines with Arroyo? I know they've started to do like party meetings with opposing parties in Sri Lanka.
Sure. So it's been changing for sure, and in the latter part of my dissertation, and actually even in Duterte, they did the same thing. The way the Chinese state and firms, they invest, the way they deal with risks for me is they try to work with strong leaders. This was a product of their experience in the 80s and moving forward. It's been changing for sure. And it's not a single strategy. I still think this is a strategy for now, but it's changing towards, you know, using institutions, for instance, to sort of like, you know, Chinese-led institutions to sort of like, you know, deal with risk. So there's an A-Data paper, right, on how China lends. And they were looking at, for instance, the, what they call this, like the different like contractual obligations that host countries need to fulfill that are sort of different from other countries. Now, there is adaptation. I argue, however, this adaptation is limited. Like even a Sri Lankan meeting was like, even if there is a meeting that involves political parties, you have to question the meaningfulness of that particular arrangement. Are these ties going to be meaningful? Are these ties going to be substantial? And more importantly, the Chinese firms and the Chinese state will still need to end up to work with working with the host country leader in place or the host country regime. It's not going to be the other political parties. It's not going to be the like the other elites. It's still going to be the state. So there is an attempt to sort of engage with others. Now, how meaningful are those? I'm not sure. My hypothesis is that any engagement will still be limited because there's going to be an opportunity cost for them. If China works with other elites and then bypasses the host country regime, there is a cost to that. The cost would be pissing off, let's say, the host country regime in power, that you might not be able to get what you want the next time around. I know that in Indonesia, for instance, the people that the Chinese state and firms work with, they're sort of other elites, but they sort of fall in the Jokowi coalition. So there's a major coalition, right, where Jokowi has his own political party, and then you have other political parties have a coalition with Jokowi. And for me, that was an important precursor for China to work with other elites. It's also about whether they are in a coalition with a regime. The same with the Philippine government under Duterte. The relationship of China with, say, with other elites in power, like Manny Pacquiao or like other sort of like other Philippine elites, was purely based on the coalition they had with Duterte during the first 4 years. Now that there's a rift in the Philippines based on other elites trying to mobilize against Duterte so they can win the Philippine presidential elections, I wonder what is China's relationship with them, whether it's cooled off or whether they had to choose. It's hard to say. Now, even the research that sort of argue China, you know, the Chinese state and firms have started to change their engagement towards, let's say, NGOs or let's say other elites. That was that those conclusions did not really those research, they don't really go against any of my findings, because even China's engagement with, let's say, the NGOs and the other elites was still based on this like win-win cooperation approach. It was still under this like government initiative. So in many ways, China does try to maintain. I still think they would prioritize the relationship with the government unless the government is hostile to them immediately, just like the Aquino government in between 2010 and 2016 in the Philippines.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, especially within their relations to civil society organizations. The limited outreach that has happened, it's always under that win-win kind of coalition. It's there's a kind of paternalism to it. But going back to the Philippines, you know, Duterte has thus far been largely been able to control the domestic elite, so perceived as strong and as actually strong. But you write in the paper or in the article that the situation also creates new risk for Chinese firms. How is this the case?
So if you have a leader who is perceived and is actually strong, it leads to an outcome I call pushback. So pushback is an outcome when the leader takes advantage leaders realize their leverage. They realize their indispensable position, and they use this position to push back against China on other interests and other political avenues. So in the Duterte administration, you know, China's advancement in the Philippines between 2016 and 2000 up until right now, it was purely based on Rodrigo Duterte. It was purely based on Duterte and his particular faction. It's not even the political party. It's not PDP Laban. It's Rodrigo Duterte and the people around him. Now, in order for them to sort of, you know, this is my view and I really believe in it. In order for them to really like move in the West Philippine Sea, to sort of take advantage of the exclusive economic zone, to make the Philippines give up the Hague arbitration rule, they had to win Duterte. So they appeased Duterte and Duterte was good with it. And Duterte knew that China needed him. So Duterte, not just Duterte, but other elites close to Duterte, they work with what I call Chinese online gambling firms, which I think I talked about in this podcast before. I call it flexible capital. The Chinese online gambling firms, they go through Duterte, but not through the elites tied to the Chinese state. They go through some other elites, particularly the Filipino-Chinese Davao-based businessmen and some of the Filipino-Chinese businessmen that are outside the oligarchy. A lot of the online gambling firms work with these elites who are also Duterte supporters, but different from the Duterte supporters who are tied to the Chinese state, like Dennis Oi. So taking advantage of the situation, Duterte invited online gambling firms to come in the Philippines provided all of this investment incentives and all of this like avenues for like getting them in and sort of protecting them and making it easy for them, you had like at the height of it, 300,000, let's say, semi-legal and illegal Chinese workers in the Philippines, particularly in Metro Manila, Cebu, and a lot of the other major cities. And that was really bad for Filipinos. Real estate prices were going up. A lot of Philippine businesses started to get bought out by the online gambling firms. You had a lot of, say, traffic. You had a lot of like tensions between the Filipino population and sort of the Chinese workers. And a lot of the Chinese workers are themselves, they're being abused by the Chinese online gambling firms. Their passports are taken. They're promised $2,000 and they're paid $600 when they get there. When these workers are abused, they run to the Chinese embassy. The Chinese embassy doesn't even help them because they're considered to have done a crime. It's really, really horrible. In many cases, I've documented as well and interviewed Chinese workers who were either sexually abused by people in the online gambling firms. Sometimes it's even horrible when the Philippine police arrest the Chinese workers. They themselves are this is hearsay, there's no proof, but I've talked to a couple of Chinese workers who told me they've been abused by the Philippine police. So in many ways, that is bad for the Chinese workers. It's also bad for the Chinese state, because the more that the online gambling firms invest in the Philippines, the more that they sort of piss off the population. And the more that the population would associate like the online gambling firms with the Chinese government. So every goodwill mission that the Chinese government tries to do in the Philippines gets rebutted by some sort of action by the online gambling firms. Now, there's been a lot of like popular conspiracy theories about online gambling firms. If you listen to Philippine analysts that, in my opinion, they don't do real research. They do desktop research. And I don't know exactly what they do and how they come up with this data. But if you talk to Philippine analysts, a lot of them would think online gambling firms are like some sort of like secret concoction by the Chinese government that was made up to penetrate, to enter the Philippines and sort of make life difficult for Filipinos. And a lot of them think that online gambling firms are firms that spy on the Philippine military or the Philippine government, and they're just like pretending to be online gambling firms. So in many ways, the Philippine public, most of them, and the Philippine elites, they think online gambling firms are tied with the Chinese state. And it's really bad for the Chinese state, because you're gonna have a population pissed at you, and you're going to have elites who are pissed at you as well. And you can't do anything about it. For Duterte, this is a win-win situation. You have the Chinese state that is willing to give you construction contracts, Kaliwa Dam, Chico River Pump Project, the foreign direct investment project for the Dito Telecommunity, which is the third telecommunications company in the Philippines, which is a joint venture with China Telecom. And you have many other smaller Chinese construction contracts. That's good for the Duterte government. Now, on the flip side, you have Chinese online gambling firms as well. At the apex of it, the approximate amount of money that they were earning was a few million dollars, probably like $10 to $20 million every week that was being paid to the Duterte government and sort of all the elites associated with the online gambling system. In fact, Duterte himself, and I wrote this in my dissertation, and in many ways, I tried not to identify them because it's really dangerous, but his fraternity brothers Duterte went to this college called San Beda. He got a law degree there. His fraternity brothers in San Beda, they were placed in the key Philippine agencies that dealt with online gambling, whether it's police, immigration, labor, taxation, whatever. So yeah, I mean, it was a win-win situation for Duterte. He gets money, he gets the Chinese government needs him, and yeah, and that's bad for the Chinese government. I call this pushback.
That absolutely makes sense. If a strong leader is actually strong, that means not only can they help Chinese firms and get investments, get in contracts, but they could also do what they want with Chinese firms or otherwise, because they are strong. Yeah. And it's also, I don't know what the correct adjective is, but fraternities worldwide, they kind of sadly run too much stuff. At least it's my experience here in America. And
It is an American institution, this fraternity thing in the Philippines. My God, that was built by the Americans.
Oh my God, that's a different story. But to solidify the empirical findings that you had in the Philippines, you also shortly go into cases in Malaysia and Indonesia. Who did you talk about in these states, and how did Chinese investments fare in these circumstances?
So for me, the Najib case is like Arroyo, a leader who was perceived to be strong but actually weak. It led to cancellation. So there were a lot of Chinese projects that went to Malaysia. The biggest issue here was the embezzlement in 1MDB. And a lot of those Chinese projects, I think only three of them were canceled. I think some other projects were renegotiated. And then some of the other projects, the Chinese firms themselves have to adjust to the host country, particularly to the demands of the new regime. so that they wouldn't encounter so much resistance. So effectively, the major Chinese projects in Malaysia, in Najib's Malaysia, were canceled when the new president came in. Some of the other projects, they had to adjust, and that was bad for, and this is what I call cancellation, which is similar to Arroyo. Now, the Jokowi case is similar to Duterte. You have a leader who is perceived to be strong, is actually strong. Chinese firms and projects went to Jokowi, built so many, they've invested in a number of things. The Jakarta-Bandung HSR, a couple of like coal-fired power plants. You have other Chinese projects. Oh, one favorite project of mine is the Indonesia Morowali Industrial Park in Central Sulawesi, where I spent a couple of weeks researching with some of my Indonesian-like colleagues. And in many ways, just like Duterte, the Chinese governments and firms, they go, the most important firms, they go to Jokowi, and they know they need to go to Jokowi in order to get something. Now, Jokowi is pushing back in the right way. Jokowi knows that the Chinese government needs him and the Chinese firms need him. Jokowi also needs them. But in many ways, Jokowi is pushing back. So in the Natuna Islands, Jokowi has been able to push back, you know, unlike Duterte, who willingly like sold out that part of the Philippines. Jokowi pushed back by tasking the Indonesian Navy and Indonesian Coast Guard to push back against Chinese fishing fleets and fishing boats that have been, what's a good word, illegally like squatting in those areas. So pushback is happening in Jokowi, but not in the same way as Duterte. It is happening in, I would say, the correct way, where he is using his own leverage to limit the territorial, I don't know what the word, the territorial sort of, I don't want to call it territorial expansion, but I think it is something, it is the violation of the Indonesian EEZs. So Jokowi is pushing back against that.
Yeah.
Oh, and I have one chapter each in my dissertation on these leaders. So it's a much, much longer story than how in my dissertation, I explain how the Chinese firms perceive, and not just Chinese firms, like how did the Chinese actors began to perceive Najib and Jokowi as these particular leaders? What was the process behind it? Who were the elites who were involved with it? So everything, all of those things, I discussed it in my dissertation. The same with the Duterte and the Arroyo chapters. They were much, much longer. Around maybe 10 to 12,000 words each per chapter.
Well, that gives me another reason why I'll have to go and read your dissertation. So what if, you know, this whole reason why I started this podcast is because I found, it was over 3 years ago now, I found, and then Juliet was able to join us, that we really appreciate really wonderful research on global China. And we really prefer a research that takes a grounded and qualitative approach, just like this research has in your dissertation did. First, are there any anecdotes from the interviews you weren't able to fit into your paper that, or this paper, that are interesting tidbits that can help us understand how Chinese firms understand risk or how they assess strength, weakness in a country's political leadership that you could share with us?
Sure. So two anecdotes, I think I wrote it in my dissertation, but two anecdotes are really interesting. So during the Duterte administration in 2016, in fact, I was in Beijing at this time. I was following the entourage. I had a couple of links with like some Filipino economic elites. So when I say Filipino economic elites, they're sort of super rich people, but they're not part of the oligarchy. So, you know, they're trying to climb up to that. They're trying to get to that level, right? But I knew some of them, and they invited me to sort of come along. I did not come along on that like entourage. I was not allowed. I'm not part of the Philippine government, but I was in the same city. I was in Beijing at this time, meeting with like these Filipino elites. That, you know, after in their hotels, and just to engage in conversations and to link with them. So I remember the initial thought of Duterte, the way that the Philippine businessmen and the way the Philippine elites were trying to sell Duterte. They were trying to sell Duterte as a strong leader who China can work with and who can protect the interests of the Chinese state and Chinese firms. In many ways, the Chinese government, the way they perceived Duterte at the start, they did not really believe that Duterte was going to be a strong leader, or rather they were skeptical of Duterte. And in many ways, this comes from their experience of investing during Arroyo. When the Chinese state and firms initially perceive Arroyo to be strong, they turn out to be wrong. And during Duterte's time, they were much more cautious. Now, I remember writing in my dissertation that when Duterte started to engage in, after Duterte's visit in October 2016, when Duterte engaged in extrajudicial killings, to increasing the budget for police, the police intelligence operations, when he started to incarcerate Philippine political elites, particularly Senator Leyla de Lima was incarcerated, and I think she still is incarcerated. a couple of like cases against governors. Three Philippine mayors from key cities were killed by the Philippine police. In many ways, all of Duterte's activities since the October 2016 meeting, and these activities were said to be authoritarian and dictatorial, which are definitely true in my view. And when I spoke to the Chinese officials about them, they were interpreted as like as something, I mean, they would never comment about the killings. It is a Philippine matter for them. But the willingness to engage in violence, the willingness to use force against people who obstruct the government and the state, and not to go through the procedure of, let's say, going to courts and everything, that was seen to be a positive by members of Chinese firms. And I remember talking to a MOFCOM official who visited Manila in 2018. This MOFCOM official was part of the Chinese entourage during Xi Jinping's visit in November 2018. I remember this official told me that in many ways, this is like how it's done in China. If you have radical demands from particular groups, it is met with violence, nothing else. And Duterte's willingness to do that was something that reminded them of leadership in China, according to this official. Now, the other anecdote I would like to talk about, and I explained this in my dissertation, it was how Joko Widodo's victory in, I think, 2014, when the Chinese state and firms dealt with Jokowi in 2014, they did not think he was going to win the elections. In many ways, Jokowi's victory in 2014 was surprising. PDIP was a sort of a small, they were a major party, but they were not tied to the sort of like existing power holders in the country. They were linked with the smaller political parties. And when Jokowi won, he created a coalition with the big political parties, right? So when Jokowi's opponent in 2014 was Prabowo, and Prabowo had the backing of the military, the backing of the police. He had the endorsement of Cecilio Bambang Yudhoyono, who was the previous president, who was the president of Indonesia for 10 years. And the Chinese firms in the state thought that Prabowo was going to win. And when Jokowi won, I remember talking to an official from the Chinese embassy in Jakarta. This official was telling me that her experience when Jokowi won was so astonishing. She's never been in a country where a leader who comes from a weaker political party would actually end up winning elections. And that, and for her, this was a proof of Jokowi's popularity, of Jokowi's strength, that he could win against Prabowo despite all odds.
There's incredible. Thank you so much for sharing those both with us and our listeners today.
And super Southeast Asia specific and super specific to like particular events.
Well, if anyone's going to enjoy hearing these stories, it's the listener of the show, which is great. And also, since you joined us last time, which I can't even remember what episode you were on, but it was a couple of years ago now.
I was in Boston.
You are now
an
assistant professor at Denver University.
I have a real salary now, so
yes.
I'm so happy.
isn't it wonderful? I'm not in academia, but salary is wonderful.
So hard. It was so horrible to be a PhD student. My God, living with that money for so many years, and sort of struggling against like hundreds, if not thousands, of people trying to get a professor job. So I'm so happy. I'm so lucky as well, and so thankful.
Yes, I can't imagine. I'm very happy I didn't go down that route, but I'm very happy for those who do, because then we get to talk about their work on the show, and I love reading their work. But for those who are maybe choosing that path and are in grad school or going towards their PhDs, going back to the grounded qualitative approach you did this research, it's turning much more difficult even without COVID to do this type of work in China. I know lots of this was done abroad or with Chinese officials abroad. But do you have any general advice for those budding graduate students or PhDs out there who might want to follow in your footsteps in conducting research like this?
Sure. So the first thing is, well, number one, I'm really supportive of like, and this is just my own personal preference from my own experience of working in this field. I'm really supportive of like people of color from the global south who are working on these topics, and at the same time want to understand what China is doing in their own countries. I talk about this because I've been in workshops before where, I'm just gonna say this because I'm really honest about it. I've talked to people about this. I've been in workshops before where I was like the only person from the global south. And when I say that, in that workshop, everybody was either white or Chinese. And of course, the case studies were countries in the global south, right? And I was like the only person from these countries. And yes. even though I consider myself as Filipino Chinese, I'm still not considered Chinese, Chinese by the people from China. So in many ways, I would argue that a lot of times people coming from my own demography would actually have a hard time sort of like entering the field, because in many ways, like there's some sort of like idea that we cannot speak Chinese and we are unable to do it. And even if we do it, we are not as good as, we don't have the connections as well. And at the same time, the advantages, I would say this as well openly, the advantages of being a white researcher is well documented in many different research in anthropology and sociology. So coming from the Global South was really, really difficult. But I would say that a lot of people like me and a lot of other people who might follow my footsteps, there is an advantage to come from a particular country dealing with China's rise. And that is the understanding of the host country setting. And that should never be underestimated. You know, if you're Lao, you're Cambodian, you would have an understanding of those countries far, far better than, let's say, me, even if I studied those countries in some years or so. So whether I'm documenting, and I would argue that from that understanding, it is possible to sort of look at China's like own engagement. It is through talking to these officials in those countries, when they are in those countries, that it becomes possible to do research outside China, especially at a time when it is becoming close to impossible to do research within China. And just so you know, I actually never did actual sort of formal research in China. I did it in Hong Kong and Macau. And in China, I was there as a tourist in 2016, when I was invited to join. And, you know, I had the right to be a tourist. I had a tourist visa. So I was there meeting up with people. I wasn't really doing research because I knew that it was already impossible to do this research with my topic. So yes, understanding the host country deeply, not just in a sort of, not treating it as a secondary setting that I feel like some people do. And sort of like from there, try to trace China's footsteps. That's what I would do.
Awesome advice. One thing that Julia and I really pride ourselves in the field is, one, to try to have younger researchers on all the time, and two, to feature as many researchers as possible from host countries, or at least those who have done research on the ground within the host countries for the longest time, because it's just sorely missed. And a good chunk of global China research, you know, it's always pitted in, if it's either in a China-centric or it's pitted somehow in a China-US battle-centric, and it's just really boring and it doesn't deal with the realities on the ground. And so that's what we try to feature on the show, and I hope we do a good enough job. But it's been so wonderful to have you on the show today. Will you stick around for recommendations?
Sure.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. And today we've been speaking about Alvin Kamba's latest work that's in the Review of International Political Economy, called How Chinese Firms Approach Investment Risk, Strong Leaders, Cancellation, and Pushback. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. All right, Alvin, do you have a recommendation for our listeners today? Something to read, listen to?
Sure. Is it possible to recommend like one of my other works?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, sure. Well, I'm going to recommend two things. One is not my work, but I would recommend the A Data paper on how China lends. I know there are a lot of limitations. That paper has a lot of limitations. Nonetheless, it is still wonderful. I think the systematic approach that they've done to looking at Chinese contracts, comparing it to Western contracts, is great. Of course, one can quibble with like the reference categories, with like the MDB samples they have, and sort of the timeline of the deals. Nonetheless, it's really great, really great research. I love it. The other paper I would recommend is, I recently published a Carnegie Endowment for International Peace paper on a comparison of the Caliwa Dam and the Chico River Pump Project in Rodrigo Duterte's Philippines. In that paper, I sort of look at why did Duterte choose the Chinese projects over the Japanese projects? And more crucially, I sort of look at the negotiations between the Chinese actors and the host country elites, particularly how it was sort of a compromise that China lost some things, the host country, that the Duterte officials lost other things. But in the end, they eventually agreed on how to structure the deal. And that, you know, that research actually has like been read by so many people. I heard that it's being circulated around Japanese development agencies, JICA. What's this? JB, one of the other Japanese banks, ADB as well. Yeah. And I heard from friends that it's now a required reading for JICA officials before they actually go to Southeast Asia and other countries. So I'm quite happy with that work. And I would, if more people can read it, that would be great.
That's great. Well, if you don't work for JICA, you should also read it. And we will put a link to it in the show notes, of course, and probably next on my reading list. And yeah, that aid data paper, like I need to look into the history as to why Cameroon releases all their contracts and why that can't be a thing that gets put out more, because that's extremely helpful. Anyway, I have two recommendations for today, and none of them are China related. I've been a little light actually in my global China reading as of late. First of all, I should have done this way at the beginning of COVID, but I stalled, but I got a treadmill desk. I am one who is lucky enough, and I'm very grateful that I'm able to work from home, but I've been tired of sitting all day, every day. And I got a treadmill desk a couple of weeks ago, and my ADHD mind allows me to just walk all day. I've been doing like a half marathon every day at just like 3 miles an hour as I'm typing away and reading away, and it's great. So I'm feeling more energy, and it's get a treadmill desk if it's something that you might feel up to. And second, I've been listening to a lot of music lately. It's how I spend most of my evenings. And one evening recently, I was listening to a wonderful electronic noise artist called Pharmacon. She had an album called Contact. That's really wonderful, nihilistic noise music. The song specifically called No Natural Order. But on that note, Alvin, thank you so much again for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Sure, thank you. I should definitely get your recommendations for the treadmill desk. I'm in the process of like getting a desk. So that's
amazing. Yeah, get. I mean, I hacked one together from Facebook Marketplace. I don't buy anything new. I can't eat appreciation. But yeah, it's super nice. It's like a electronic standing desk, and then you can get these walking treadmills. I mean, Amazon has them, but I got it at Facebook Marketplace, and I think I got like $400 really altogether, and I feel great. But thanks again.